This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also listen to over at progressive.org. Today we're going to be talking about Darfur and what we can do about that human rights disaster area. With me to discuss this is one of the leading experts on Sudan, Sharon Hutchinson. She's a professor of anthropology and African studies at the University of Wisconsin. Her scholarly work on Sudan was quite path-breaking, and she spent a lot of time there, including as a human rights monitor. And she's been trying to set up schools there as well, which is quite interesting. Sharon Hutchinson, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you very much.
How'd you get interested in Sudan in the first place?
Well, I started off 25 years ago as a graduate student in anthropology, and I wanted to study an area that had experienced a lot of traumatic changes because I was interested in that. So I started off in the southern part just before the Southern War took off. And then throughout that 21-year war, I continued to go in and monitor and do research and do other actions.
Wasn't that dangerous?
Sometimes it was very dangerous, yes.
What was the most harrowing experience you had?
I had an assassination attempt on my life once.
Really? How'd that come about?
I don't really want to go into that on this radio, if you don't mind.
Oh, that's right. I didn't know about that. Was it a close call?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Did that rattle you for a while?
Yes.
I can only imagine. Wow. But you kept going back anyway?
Yes.
And why?
I guess I felt an obligation. I've been working in this area for so long, and I'm one of the few people that in the southern area saw what was going on the grounds. And so it was one of the few areas that some voice of the people might get through, some information. And so because of the language skills I had and knowing everybody on the ground for so long, I had access to all kinds of information that other people didn't. And I felt an obligation to use that and to expose that.
You were a civilian protection monitor for a little bit. Can you tell me about that?
Yes. I've tried many ways to try to help people of the Sudan on the ground. And I started off as an academic, and I continue to write books and do things like that. But at some point, during the peace negotiation process, very long peace negotiation process, I got a call. Basically, they were going to set up a monitoring team to protect civilians in the southern area from military violence. And this was going to be a new operation. They'd never had it. And so when I got a call from the State Department and their outsource people, I thought about it for a long time, but I decided I really needed to go because they didn't have many people who actually had prior experience in Sudan, and I knew that most of the violence would take place in the area where I worked, mostly among the newer, because that's where all the oil is. So I accepted that, and I did go for a number of months, but there are a lot of restrictions placed and a lot of politicking that goes on beyond. In principle, the Civilian Protection Monitoring Team was a totally independent force that could cross enemy lines at will and photograph, interview people. And we did a lot of that. But this was also during the period of the peace negotiations. And both the governor of Sudan and the southern rebels, the Sudan People's Liberation Army, had already signed a cessation of hostilities agreement. So whenever we found out that agreement was being broken and we started passing that information up the line, sometimes that was troubling to the people at the top because they didn't have any really ways to enforce it, and they were worried that the peace talks might get off kilter or people might walk out. So after a while, there was information that was being, shall I say, not publicized or suppressed.
Was there pressure on you not to report?
No. Well, it was the channels of reporting and how the reports were written and who took responsibility and when they were issued. But we gathered a tremendous amount of information that was very important. And I'm glad I served. But in the end, I decided that I could actually do some more better work alone.
And what was the nature of that work you did alone then?
After that, I went back again to work with help identify where the internally displaced people were in the oil region for basically USAID and other government officials who were trying to plan ahead for when the peace agreement, which was eventually signed in January 2005, they were trying to plan ahead about where they would target, you know, their aid and try to get people settled. So I did that. And then I've done other things since I've come back, include build schools, et cetera.
Tell me about the building of schools. Well, how did you get involved in that, and is that something that's ongoing?
Yes, it's definitely ongoing. After I came back from serving on the Civilian Protection Monitoring Team and serving these things for finding IDPs in the area, there was also a court case that was developing in which U.S. federal courts, in which Talisman Energy, an oil company that had served in the southern Sudan,
was a Canadian company, correct,
was being sued and accused basically of complicity in genocidal violence in the oil area. So at some point, I was requested to serve as a get involved in that case as an expert. That case now has been, it's in deep trouble and all kinds of things. But in the process, I received some money. And then I took that money and I started a nonprofit along with two other people who are very interested in Sudan 2 years ago. And it's called Schools for Sudan. And we have built three schools now in southern Sudan. And we have now currently 27 teachers on salary, the second year into them. The primary schools, the humble schools, Ben. I mean, it's not like you know, cement and things. Some of it's cement, but it's basically put in the supplies, we put in the teachers, we, you know, take care of books and these sorts of things. But they're in the second year, and they're only schools that have been, have paid teachers, actually, in the entire
time. Are these schools for displaced people, or?
I put them in the area that had been most affected by some of the oil-related violence in the Western Upper Nile. And so, yes, people are coming back to those areas. But as the whole situation in Sudan is very unstable, I would not be surprised within a number of years they're destroyed or burnt down. But still, I felt that after waiting all of these years and having worked in the area, when there's finally a peace agreement, even though I don't have tremendous confidence in the peace agreement, I couldn't say, you know, no, I won't invest in the area. You know, I wanted to. I've been waiting to do this. So I feel very good about that.
I'm speaking with Sharon Hutchinson. She started this Schools for Sudan project. She's a professor of anthropology and African studies at the University of Wisconsin. Her expertise scholarly is Sudan. She's been a human rights activist there for many, many years. What is going on in Sudan, or in Darfur in particular, right now?
Well, in Darfur, things are very bleak. As you may know, ever since February 2003, there was a small rebellion, which saying that the area had been marginalized by the central government and there's a lot of discrimination, et cetera, and they were trying to get some kind of representation, power, wealth sharing into their areas. Now, this took place during the time where the other vortex of violence, which is in the south, that war was just being negotiated a solution. And so the people in Darfur, at least these military leaders, felt that they were going to be left out and not get any kind of advantage at all. And so there was an explosion of violence. And they were quite effective initially. They managed to target several MiG planes and helicopter gunships on the tarmac in their area in the government. And this caught the government's attention very much. And when that happened, the government tried to counterattack for these and target these people. But they didn't succeed very well, so they began to arm and inflame ethnic tensions in the area.
These are the so-called Janjaweed.
Janjaweed, yes. They began to arm the who are self-identified Arabs and basically tell them, you know, go rape, pillage, burn. We'll back you up with helicopter gunships. We'll back you up with MiGs. We'll give you the arms, the trucks. You know, just basically clear the area. And so their counterinsurgency campaign became a campaign not so much targeting the rebel military groups initially, but just all the people, because you can clear them out. And this went on for a while the North-South peace negotiations were going on, and everybody kind of kept quiet because they didn't want to derail the peace talks. But soon, suddenly it became so loud, so explosive, that Colin Powell, finally, in September 2004, you know, after some investigations, had to say that this is a genocide that was taking place, and then that's started...
He used the G word. But nothing has happened.
He used a G word, and in the same breath he said, this is not going to change our policy towards Sudan.
But so, when the Secretary of State of the United States says that genocide is going on, aren't there laws on the books or treaties that the U.S. is a party to that require the government of the United States to do something more than pay lip service?
We thought so. The Genocide Convention, I should say, I'm in Wisconsin now, and the people of Wisconsin have a special relationship to the Genocide Convention because it was William Proxmire back in the 60s and 70s and, you know, and 80s that actually was the senator who forced, through a series of daily speeches in the Senate to finally get the Genocide Convention passed. What people don't realize is that the Genocide Convention has a formal definition of what is genocide, which is broader than people's perhaps lay assumptions. And it includes, you know, killing members of the group, trying to, you know, undercut their livelihoods and other kinds of things. It doesn't require that basically it target every single member, but it has to, you know, intentionally want to kill or destroy them as a group. And so on that definition, which is broader, I think Colin Powell's statement is quite correct. The problem is after that, then, you know, what do you do? According to the Genocide Convention, the first article says that, you know, we who sign this thing are committed to, you know, prevent and to punish genocide. And the word to prevent is key. The other key element about that convention is that in the definition of genocide, it says you have to identify the intent to destroy in whole or part a group based on its ethnic, national, religious identity. And that issue of intent is hard to prove, right? You can perhaps prove it by sort of circumstantial evidence, but very rarely is there going to be a, you know, an email or a letter, you know.
So there's no Mein Kampf in Darfur.
Exactly. I mean, well, there. I think there's evidence of it, but there's plenty of ways to wiggle around that if you want to avoid getting too deeply involved. And so what happened is when Colin Powell made that declaration, there, I think it's Article 8 of the convention that says, you know, parties to the convention may refer this issue to the UN if they think it'll be helpful. So basically what happened was, in my opinion, only my opinion, the Bush administration overlooked Article 1, which says now we should basically do something and say, we'll pass this hot potato to the UN, okay? And then the UN said, well, we'll pass this hot potato to the International Criminal Court, where it kind of stalled. And so that route there is pretty elaborate and disappointing, shall we say, because, you know, back in 1994, when the Rwandan genocide was really, you know, horrible, the Clinton administration took the policy of never calling it a genocide while it was going on, but prefacing what the State Department said with acts of genocide have occurred. And there were some very telling and embarrassing moments when the spokesperson was questioned by journalists, you know, well, you know, how many acts of genocide does it take to make a genocide in Darfur? The fear was at that time that if you actually said something, you had to do it, and that was do something about it, and that was the assumption all along. But now, you know, we have a situation where our administration has declared it a genocide, but effectively has given a lot of hand-wringing. But
I mean, the pathetic thing is Bill Clinton apologized for it, Madeleine Albright apologized for it, so what are we going to have? George W. Bush 10, 15 years from now? Condoleezza Rice apologizing for not doing anything in Darfur?
Well, I think there's more subtle movements, you know, to say, well, actually the Genocide Convention never really meant that, you know, these sorts of reinterpretations. But up until this time, that was the assumption, that if you said it was a genocide, you actually had to do something. Or you can change it by saying, well, we did something. We passed it to the UN or we did this. It's unfortunate our actions weren't effective, but, you know.
I'm speaking with Sharon Hutchinson. She's a professor of anthropology and African studies at the University of Wisconsin. She has spent 25 years groping for some answers to the calamities that have befallen Sudan. Tell me why the United States hasn't done more. I mean, I was stunned when I found out that the Central Intelligence Agency, for instance, in 2005 had flown the head of Sudan's intelligence in a CIA plane to Washington for, a get-together. You wouldn't think that's what the U.S. government would do when the same U.S. government had just called the government of Sudan guilty of genocide.
Well, I think you put your finger on it. I think there's been a tectonic shift in geopolitical relations post 9/11, and particularly since President Bush's declaration of a global war on terrorism. Up until that time, in the previous 50 years, with all of our new UN conventions and human rights, paperwork, shall we say, there was hope that there would be some kind of general consensus that genocide or these kind of egregious violence against people by their own states could be overcome. But once the global war on terrorism was declared, you seem to have a shift in the sense that the big fear now by the powerful countries, the Bush administration and others, is not so much, genocidal violence in different places, but rather the boogaboo of a collapsed state, a state which, has no administration to talk to, a state that can become a hotbed of terrorism. Now, Sudan is interesting here because you must remember that between 1991 and 1996, Sudan was the home of Bin Laden. That's where he was based. In 1997, Clinton administration made sure that, all U.S. businesses could no longer, be involved there. In 1998, when we had those explosions and the terrorist attacks in those two East African U.S. embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam, what did President Clinton do? He sent off two cruise missiles, one to Afghanistan, he missed Bin Laden, and the other to Khartoum, because the pharmaceutical plant, which is a fiasco, but the point is that they knew that there were a lot of what thought of terrorist activities taking place in that area. So after 9/11, okay, the current regime in Khartoum of Omar Bashir came in a coup d'etat in 89. And it's a very militaristic Islamicist regime, very determined. And so they were very much a pariah state, okay, particularly with regard to the U.S. government. But after 9/11, they saw an opportunity, rightfully, that they could shift. And so they immediately came forward and said, yes, President Bush, we will volunteer to cooperate on your war. Global war on terrorism. And at that point, we had Bin Laden in our country, know a lot about him. He might be out of date or information, but we know something. And so then suddenly, that shift took place. And the government of Khartoum has been very successful in sort of playing off, dribbling out information perhaps, or maybe it's information, I don't know, but maintaining that linkage as a way of diffusing pressure the Bush administration could place on them, both in the southern conflict earlier and in the Darfur conflict.
So essentially, if you play ball with Washington on war on terror, you can get away with genocide.
Those are your words, but it certainly looks
and like
that.
And it's not just Washington. There are other big powers who Absolutely. Are covering for genocide in the Sudan. China is one. Explain what China's all about.
Yes,
there.
Well, you see, the way our world is organized at the moment, the only real way to trump state sovereignty rights, for example, to bring in UN military forces or peacekeeping forces to protect a minority population within a state that's being slaughtered, the only way to do that is through the UN Security Council. And the only way in this UN Security Council, of course, has several vetoes on it, including China, Russia, US, France, anyway. So the point is that if a weak government, like the Khartoum government at the time, can have a strong relationship with a veto-wielding state, then they have a lot of immunity. In this case, China is the main one because China gets, let's say, half of the oil that is flowing out of Sudan right now goes to China. So it's a very important source of this. And it's important to realize that almost all of this oil is in the southern Sudan. And this oil did not, even though it was discovered way back in 78, it was not tapped, and Sudan did not become an oil-exporting state until 1999. Through all that period, the conflict in the south kept the oil in the ground. But once it started flowing, suddenly you'd be amazed of how much geopolitical relations shifted towards Sudan once it became an oil-exporting state. Just a few days before they turned the tap on for the first time, the IMF and the World Bank, which had sanctioned Sudan from 1993 because they hadn't been paying their loan interests, suddenly decided just a few days, I think that they can pay their debts now, so we're going to lift those sanctions. You have the power of the government of Sudan can start sort of talking to neighboring countries that were perhaps hostile in the past, saying, well, you know, if you tone down your issues or cooperate with in other ways, or we can perhaps send some cheap oil your way. So everything shifts.
Getting great leverage.
But the point is the U.S. government, U.S. corporations, Western corporation, some of the Western one, but U.S. for sure, was not in there, no oil companies. And so now the whole sort of global oil grab, the tensions about where, who's going to control this between Asian countries and Western U.S. countries, is very much focusing in on Sudan. The main benefactors from Sudan's oil now are China, Malaysia, India, other places, these developing countries that are, you know, need resources. And so, and they are using that leverage because basically China has told the Security Council, in no uncertain terms, that if they in any way try to send in UN troops to Sudan without Sudan government's permission to protect the people of Darfur, they'll veto it.
So that raises really the question of the day. I mean, how to help the people of Darfur now, more than 200,000 of whom have died in the last 3 years and 2 million displaced, right? Or are those numbers low?
Oh, there's, yes, 2.5 at least. I mean, there's people in Chad now because the Janjaweed, backed up by the government of Sudan, has been incursions into the refugee camps on the Chadian border and displacing people there. But a minimum of 300,000, 400,000.
That's just horrifying.
It is horrifying. And so...
But now to the question, if the UN Security Council, because China says it's going to veto, is not going to allow a UN blue-helmeted force there, and the African Union force of 7,000 troops has been terribly ineffectual, what's going to happen?
The way things look like right now, it's not good. The African Union force, you know, has said over the period it's incapable. It doesn't have the mandate. It doesn't have the resources. It doesn't have the logistical capacity, and what capacity it has been undermined tremendously by, you know, red tape, by the Khartoum government, you know, not moving in the equipment that they have, all these sorts of things. And and there was a big assumption that when the Darfur peace agreement was signed between the government of Sudan and only one rebel faction out of three, really, at this point, that the idea was that that was going to allow this new robust UN mandate to come absorb the African Union 7,000 troops and create a much bigger one. And so now that's all been reneged on. And more than being reneged on, the African Union today, I believe, has basically capitulated, saying that even we think that the government of Sudan, you know, should we don't want to turn anything over to the UN unless the government of Sudan gives it's okay.
So they're empowering the government of Sudan.
Well, plus their finances have been continuing. They become increasingly financially dependent on the Arab League, which is 100% backing the government of Sudan's position. So you have a situation here where it's a total stalemate. There's lots of things people could do. I mean, they could create a no-fly zone, for example, from Chad, like we used to do with the Kurds and, you know, northern Iraq. There are ways to put targeted sanctions, and there's a way to beef up the International Criminal Court's threats to, you know, to have trials for some of these leading Sudanese officials. But if these same leading Sudanese officials are being, you know, taken by airplane by the CIA to talk about counter-terrorist issues in Washington, you know, that's not an area that's probably going to get a lot of things.
It doesn't seem likely, does it? What hope do you have of pressuring either the U.S. government or other Security Council governments to do something?
Well, I think that there has to be a lot of continuing pressure within the United States and all of these places, public pressure, because the only thing that's going to, for example, help the U.S. government pressure countries like China countries like Russia. There are things, you know, there are deals that could be made to pressure these countries to perhaps, you know, pull back a little bit on that or create these things. What I haven't seen mentioned, though, is very ironic, is that now we have a kind of stopgap measure which the African Union forces are going to stay there, supposedly, until December 31st. But what people aren't saying is that after that, the African Union is supposed to be chaired by the government of Sudan, which takes it over in 2007. A year ago, they were supposed to take over the African Union as the head of it, or the leading member. And there was such an outcry around the world because, those troops were in their territory to protect their Sudanese people from the Sudanese government. And so now, I ask myself, well, what's going to happen then?
And that would make a joke of it, wouldn't it?
Well, I think that's what we're facing right now. So many of these things, basically what's going on in Sudan is exposing the fact that we have a great many, conventions and human rights norms and things that we're supposed to hold, but we have no implementation process that's truly effective. And we have a kind of backtracking, really, on the idea, that there are points where human deaths and human rights do and can trump state sovereignty claims.
It just makes a mockery of the Genocide Convention and then of comments like never again that were uttered so many times since World War II and the Holocaust there. I mean, it just must be terribly difficult for you, Sharon Hutchinson, having dealt with this issue for 25 years, to come up to this point where it looks like nothing is going to continue to happen.
But, we can still do quite a few things. I mean, part of it is we have to debunk some of the logic behind this. I mean, if you look at our post 9/11 mentality, or at least administration mentality, is that there's some kind of zero-sum game between security and justice, or human rights and order. And from my perspective, seeing what's going on, this is quite misconceived. Because if there aren't some elements of justice, there aren't some elements of, how can you ever have a long-standing order in any way or any security? So I think we can, continue to call attention to some fundamental, misconceptions, in my opinion, that govern these things. They're I guess the way that I keep going, and this is honest, is perhaps part of it is, for me to walk away, it's one less voice, it's one less set of information, it's one less call. So I feel like to do so would be an abandonment of a nation and a peoples that I care a great deal about, but also to keep sort of a view on the marginal difference voices can make, organizing.
There are student groups that are involved now, too.
There are student groups. And this is very heartening. I mean, the Wisconsin system, UW-Wisconsin system, has, put its regions have passed something saying there's going to be no investment.
Is this a national thing, too, this divestiture movement?
Yes, states have divested.
How many?
I don't know, actually, now New Jersey, California, I think, Oregon. But it's a big mass movement. And many people say, this is politicizing the economy or the whatever. But I think in some ways you can build leverage through some of these things, because some of these companies are international companies that are, the U.S. doesn't have any companies in there, but there are other ones like Siemens in Germany, or and those companies are profiting on all of this.
So there's
violence.
This new divestiture movement, like the anti-apartheid.
But it's not the silver bullet. Movement. I mean, it's not going to.
Well, we don't have a silver bullet, but we need to use whatever we have. Sharon Hutchinson, thanks so much for being my guest today on this very troubling issue,
Thank you very much, Darfur. Thank you for having me.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.